Well, it is May 3rd, 2022, and I am still here. Last week, I was a little concerned whether I would be or not. I'll update you on my health situation, if you care. I was, I think I mentioned last week that I had a echo stress test, and it was kind of funky on the EKG at the very end. I lasted the whole time. You would have been proud of me, but if I had had to stay on that treadmill another 2 seconds, I would have collapsed. But I did make it, and so they, you know, it was a little squirrely, so they decided to do a cath. And so that news is not good. So this is Tuesday. I've got sometime either tomorrow or the next day or next day, I'm going to have two stents put in. Hopefully that will work. If not, then I get to have bypass surgery. And I don't really want to have that done. But, you know, the miracle of modern medicine never ceases to amaze me. That I went to Park West. And the only reason I went there probably is because my brother is a cardiologist, and his practice operates right beside that hospital. And when they do their procedures, they do them in the cath lab or the lab there, or operating rooms and so forth. So anyway, that's why I ended up there. My brother was there with me at the end of it. I'm still on the table, and he comes in and says, "Well, you've got some blockages." So, you know, and I said, "Well, I mean, I've taken my cholesterol medicine." Apparently, you can't continue to eat whatever. The cholesterol medicine is not going to take care of all the issues, especially if you're, you know, going to Southern Craft and getting the burn ends. You know what I'm saying? So I'm going to have to cut back even more and really get that cholesterol level way down there. And hopefully this procedure that they're going to do on me will work, and I won't have to go to the next step. Of course, everybody's panicking in my household, but I you know, and that's what bugs me the most, and I don't want them to feel that way. I could use some prayers for them, and hopefully everything will work out just fine. At least that's what I'm planning on. So in the interim, I'm just going to keep being the car guru and a car dealer. I'm here in the recording studio at Gateway Ford, which happens to be the opposite end of my office where my desk is. I do a lot, most of my work over there and a little bit over here. And got my Schwinn Apple Crate bicycle in front of me, and I'm surrounded by all my peaceful memories, pictures and stuff. People walk in my office and they go, "Whoa, you got a lot of stuff." And I do. I like being surrounded by my stuff. You may feel the same way. Hey, do you realize that when we all switch to electric cars and trucks, but something bad happens to our electric grid, then we are stuck at home or wherever we happen to run out of electricity in the battery? So when we are tied, I've just been thinking about this. Do you think about stuff sometimes just that you have no control over? I certainly do. Sometimes when I wake up at like 3 in the morning, when we are tied to electricity forever, we are beholden to the public utilities that are regulated by who or by whom? The government. That's right. And that's not a real comforting feeling. Right now, oil companies compete for our business. They do raise and lower prices based on the oil markets, refinery capacity, from what I understand, and the forces of competition in the market. Now, cars have become very fuel efficient, so we can travel further and further on a tank of fuel than we could 10 or 20 years ago. It just amazes me how efficient the engines are on cars today. That little Ford Maverick will go 45 miles per gallon, or 45 miles on a gallon of gas in the city. That's pretty good. So anyway, with electric cars, we are limited in range, just like we are on gasoline-powered cars, but we are limited by battery capacity and the vehicle efficiency. So, you know, that's similar. But who regulates the price of electricity? Is that a competitive market? Can electrons be taxed like gasoline can be? Well, you bet it can, and it will. We will either be paying a use fee to travel on roads. Don't know how that's going to hit our pocketbooks, but it could. Or a surcharge on electricity, or a combination of both of those. Now, I've been thinking about this. When we have a blackout, there will be no charging. When we have tornadoes, for example, that knock out electrical grids in the Middle West or Middle, not I start to say Middle East, but in the Midwest is what I'm trying to say, there will be no charging. So when we cannot afford our electric bills, for example, when we collectively, there will be no charging. In other words, I think we're losing a certain degree of our freedom with electric cars. Now, it doesn't matter how I feel about it because it's happening. At some point in all of our futures, we will be driving cars that do not have internal combustion engines in them. Our antiques might. I mean, hopefully our, I guess my Mustang and a couple other my vehicles, my little Corvair and Corvair truck and Bronco, I'll still be able to get fuel somewhere. I don't know whether I'll have to make it or not. But we are losing a certain degree of our freedom with electric cars. Now, cars will run on alcohol, ethanol, fossil fuels, liquid natural gas, biofuels that are made out of plants. But electric cars run on one thing, and we have to be plugged in to something to be able to use that one thing. So what is that dependency going to look like in 10 or 20 years? I don't know, but I guess we are destined to find out, are we not? All right, well, I'm going to take my first little break, and I will be back in just 1 minute. Okay, I'm back. You know, I'd have to admit that the car business is unique in the way its products are sold and through whom they are sold. Think about it. When you want to buy a refrigerator, you don't go to a Whirlpool store and then a Maytag store or a LG store. We used to do that. I remember when there were dealers that lots of times they were tire stores. You remember that when tire stores sold appliances? I always wondered how that connection got made. I'm sure I could research it and find out. But there was probably a Maytag store, and that's all that they sold. But now you go to Best Buy, you go to some type of furniture dealer that sells appliances, and you pick from a bunch of different brands, Home Depot, Lowe's, for example. When you go to a clothing store like Gap, now they only sell clothing from Gap. It says Gap on it. The store is owned and operated by Gap, so they're not basically selling you Sears brand clothing or Lands' End or whatever. Now, in a car business, you do have to go to different stores for different brands. The Ford store that is down the street from you, if you happen to live in Greenville, me, or if you live in Johnson City, Johnson City Ford, that Ford store is not owned by Ford. You all understand that, right? The Toyota store in Johnson City or in Kingsport or in Bristol, it's not owned by Toyota. They're owned by other companies, and many times those companies are very seldom will you find a car dealership that is just a simple partnership. Most of them, I'd say all of them, are some form of corporation, either a C-class or a C-corporation where you have stockholders and the owners own stock in the company, and you have a corporate income tax that has to be paid, and then pay or bonuses are paid out to the owners, and then they pay income taxes on what they get from the corporation. Or an S-type corporation, which is what Gateway is, where the corporation doesn't pay tax. Everything flows to my tax return. So anything that we make at Gateway Ford as far as net profit, bottom line profit, I am taxed for that personally, in addition to the income that I take out of the company. So that's the difference between a C corporation and an S corporation. And either a C or an S is what owns most of the car dealerships. They're owned by either individuals like me, or they're owned by other companies, which may happen to be corporations as well. I mean, you look at AutoNation, for example. They hold more dealerships and franchises than any other single entity, but they are the franchisee, just like I'm a franchisee. I mean, I have a franchise that I arranged to get from Ford and from Nissan. Now, I didn't pay them for that franchise. It's the car business a little bit unique in that you don't buy the franchise. The franchise is awarded to you if you meet their standards and if you have certain capitalization requirements and facility requirements. There's a whole lot of requirements in order to be a car dealer. But the bottom line is that these dealerships are not owned by the manufacturer. Now, when you look at a company like Tesla, Tesla doesn't have traditional car dealerships. They have been able to circumvent dealer franchise laws, which have protected dealers for many years. To understand how this came about, you have to go back a long way. Now, Tesla is a relatively new company in the grand scheme of things. They haven't been around that long, and they developed a different system where, I mean, there is a Tesla store right next to the Westtown Mall in Knoxville, and you can go in there and order a vehicle, and in a certain period of time, they'll either deliver it to your house or deliver it to that store, and you could pick it up. They don't have dealers. They don't have independent dealers. You are buying directly from Tesla. Now, the thing about that is that, you know, when the dealership model, you have a lot of competition because dealers are competing against each other. With Tesla, you really don't. I mean, they will have competition. They'll have other electric vehicle makers that are going to be out there and selling vehicles. Ford, for example, is going to be a competitor for Tesla. But Ford is going to get it done through their dealers that are, there's like 3,500 dealers in the nation, or Ford dealers. Probably 17,000, 18,000 other dealers in this country. I think that number's right. But let's talk about how this franchise system got started. If you go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, you might see a car parked outside of a general store, and a clerk inside would be happy to take your order for one. Sometime around that same time frame, a guy named Carl Benz, he was considered the first internal combustion engine maker and built the first car. And for a while, Sears sold vehicles, the Sears motor buggy, through its mail order catalog. Some companies even sold cars on a literal installment plan. Customers would order one, and sometimes they would order the parts, and they would be delivered through the mail, believe it or not, and over a course of months, they could assemble their own car. Some enterprising business people became full-time car dealers. A guy named William Metzger, who started selling electric and steam-powered cars of various makes in Detroit in 1898, is usually credited as being the first car dealer in existence. This was one of the big issues in the first 10 or 15 years or so of the automotive industry. What is the best model to sell cars to the public? Now, Henry Ford got involved real early. I mean, from 1906 to 1908, Ford made about 6,000 Model N's. You know, you think about the alphabet. He was selling Model N's back then. Most people just thought that the first car that Ford came out with was called the Model T. It was not. It's just to where it fell in the alphabet. But that was an astounding number compared to the other car makers. Now, at that point, Henry Ford had not started using a moving assembly line. It was still building many cars in place and then selling them in pieces to people. But he figured out that this particular model was not going to work. But there were about 253 active automakers in the United States in 1908. That's the year that the Model T went on sale. Now, by 1929, there were just 44. But even with 44 car makers, 80% of all cars sold in the U.S. that year were made by just three companies. And Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler were the big dogs, the big three. But they all followed Ford's example and figured out that in order to be able to sell the vehicles and service the vehicles and have multiple locations where people had ready access to the cars, then they had to be sold through franchise dealers. Franchise dealers had a foothold in the community. They knew people in the community. They built service departments where they could service the cars, and they did require a lot of service and repairs. They stocked parts so that people could get their cars repaired quickly. You may say, well, why didn't the manufacturer do this? Well, they just didn't have the manpower or the expertise to be able to do it at that time. So, and the Henry Fords of the world, because of this dealer setup, had the power to demand that the dealers were exclusive. They called the shots, in other words. And a lot of dealers had a hard time making it because if Ford didn't provide enough vehicles for them to meet their overhead and they couldn't go to any other, couldn't buy any other brands or represent any other brands, then it put them in financial hardship and they would go out of business. So car dealers were at the mercy of automakers. And, you know, a car company could decide to, well, if this one dealer wasn't doing a good job, then they could open up another Ford dealership just right down the street. And so the automaker could decide to also cut a dealership if they weren't performing. They didn't like them for some reason. They just stopped selling the vehicles. So what happened was dealers had a lot of local pull and regional pull. So they went to their state legislators and to their governors and to anybody that would listen to them. And they campaigned to get some type of protection. And so that's where state franchise laws came from. And you know, in the 40s and 50s, you had these sort of mom-and-pop car dealers complaining that they were being taken advantage of. So this led to these laws, and they still serve me. I mean, when I have an issue with the factory and they're putting pressure on me for something, then I can go through an attorney and enforce the agreements that we have. I have a franchise agreement with Ford. I have a franchise agreement with Nissan. I've had them with Chevrolet and Oldsmobile and all that stuff. You know, back when I was an Oldsmobile dealer and General Motors decided we're going to drop the Oldsmobile brand. Well, they couldn't just drop it and not compensate me for some. I mean, all of a sudden, what if I was just a standalone Oldsmobile dealer? I wasn't. I had Chevrolet. But if they had just decided to pull it, I mean, I'm just left out in the cold. So they had to pay me to take it away from me. And that's the kind of thing that laws help protect. It also protects my area of responsibility. Like, there cannot be another Ford dealer in my market area. So basically, it covers all of Greene County and a lot of Hawkins County. I'm sorry, I just drew a blank. So Hawkins County and maybe just a tad bit of Hamblin County, but there's a map and it shows that what is my region of responsibility. Now, let's say that the population in this area, let's say some big plant or a bunch of plants came in, opened up, and people started moving here and the population went way up and my sales were just not serving the market, then they could change the size of the market. Now, I could fight against that in court and could possibly win or lose. But anyway, that's what state franchise laws do for car dealers is protect us from aggressive manufacturer tactics. And then these laws also keep General Motors, Ford, Toyota, anybody like that from opening their own outlets. Now, some of you may say, well, that, you know, why don't they just go the Tesla model? Because it doesn't work as good. The dealer franchise model is a more efficient way to take care of customers. Just, I mean, when you buy a Tesla or a Rivian or a Lucid, I know you probably haven't heard of any of those. Well, you have Tesla, and maybe you've heard of Rivian, but these are new electric car makers that are bypassing the state, a lot of the state franchise laws. Now, there's some states like Tennessee, you can, but like Texas and several other states that have said, no, you're not coming in here. Michigan just recently passed a law allowing Tesla to come in. So, you know, there are good reasons for traditional franchise dealerships, and at least in the next 25, 30 years, I think it's still a good model and will make a difference for car buyers for a long time to come. But there's going to be more pressure for a direct marketing model. But I really just don't think it's in the best interest of consumers. It makes access to repairs and stuff more difficult. But, you know, they're saying that the electric cars aren't going to need the level of maintenance that internal combustion engine cars do. So that's also true. We shall see. But anyway, I'm going to take my last break, and I'll be back in just 1 minute. Okay, I'm back. You know, I'm just a real advocate for locally owned businesses. And maybe I'm a dinosaur, but I just feel that the relationship that owners of a business have. You know, when they live in the community, they work in the community, they hire people that are local, they, you know, sponsor soccer teams. You know, I sponsor all not soccer teams, but volleyball teams in Greenville. I think there's 342 participants, and I don't know how many teams, but I bought a whole lot of T-shirts and paid a lot of entry fees. And we are connected to the community. I mean, we've been here for 50 years. You don't see that with certain types of businesses. I bought a bicycle from the Trek store in Johnson City. And, I mean, I like it. It's an electric bicycle. I bought my wife one as well. But it just seems like that is a big corporate entity, Trek Bikes, and they are not connected to Johnson City. They have a store there, and they have people that are probably from this area that work there. But it's not like, you know, a mom-and-pop bicycle shop that has been there for a lot of years, and they know the people that come in and go out, and they sell, you know, they participate in bicycle events and sponsorships and stuff like that. That's the kind of business that I like to do business with, and I don't think I'm alone in that. But, you know, if I can help you in any way with your automotive-related decisions, that's kind of what I'm here for. Feel free to send me a message, 423-552-2020. That's my personal cell phone, the only one I have. Or you can send me an email to LennyLawson2020@gmail.com. And Lenny is spelled L-E-N-N-I-E, like my mommy decided to do it. So if you have any questions, don't hesitate to give me a call, and I will see you tomorrow.